This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
And this is The 10th Voice. It's the second Saturday, so it's the Santa Moran Radio Book Club. And today, I have good news and I have bad news. The good news is we're talking to Penny Mickleberry and Renee Bess about Bell City. The bad news is we don't have Rashawn in the studio because the flu is going around in both Missouri and Kansas, and he's down with it. But let me check that I've got both Penny and Renee on the line. Penny?
Yes, you've got me. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. And Renee?
Hi, Elizabeth. It's Renee.
And Rashawn wanted to make sure, Penny, that I told you that he loves your writing style. And he had questions. He's very disappointed.
I'm disappointed as well, but I wish him well because that flu thing is really doing a number on everybody, I guess, this winter.
It is. It's a particularly bad one. Well, let's start the conversation, and I want to start out. I'm very excited to have two authors on the show because the panel is usually a mix of authors and readers. And I want to ask each of you what genres you write in and some of the novels or series that you write. Renee, I'll start with you.
Okay, my genres have changed. I started with purely romance, and then I went into romance with intrigue, and then I found myself on the road to general dramatic fiction, which feels very comfortable to me right now.
I love general dramatic fiction. You've also written short stories, is that correct?
I've written some poetry and some short fiction, yes. I was convinced years ago that short fiction might take more skill than a novel because you have to develop characters, scenes, a setting, an atmosphere with an economy of words, whereas in a novel you have more time and more space to do all this development. But it was a short story that just kept getting longer for me, and that's how I wrote my first book, Leave of Absence.
And what you described about the short story is pretty much what Dorothy Allenson said on one of the panels, that the short story art form is particularly difficult to write for those reasons that you said.
Mm-hmm.
And Penny, what about you?
I write, or I suppose in the past, primarily mysteries. I have three mystery series, 10 novels. Bell City was my first non-mystery novel, and it was an effort and it was a journey. I also am a playwright. I have a collection of short stories due out in the fall by BLS Press is the publisher. And I agree with Renee 100% that the short story is a particularly challenging form. But I'm also a playwright, and people have said, oh my goodness, I don't know how you do that. I love writing plays. They are, yes, a challenge, but a different kind of challenge, and one that I enjoy. And may I take a moment, please, Elizabeth, to say, Renee, it is lovely to meet you. I feel that I know you through your books, but we've never met, and I appreciate having this opportunity to share with you. Well, I feel exactly the same way, Penny, and hopefully we'll meet at a conference this summer. I'm looking forward to it. Okay, great.
And I have to admit that I asked Renee in July 2016 to please be on the show. Was so delighted when she was able to for your novel, Penny, because Renee, I love your posts and comments, and I could tell from social media you're someone that I had to have.
Oh, thank you very much.
Penny, interesting circumstance. I was talking to you in the hallway in Chicago, 2017 Golden Crown Literary Society Conference, and you mentioned Bell City, and I told you about the radio show. Shortly thereafter, you became a Bywater author, and because I'm a Bywater editor, I got to read your new novel, Death's Echoes, which is out later this month. So, who knew?
Who knew? Serendipity, I suppose. But I'm thankful for it. I remember that hallway conversation, and I remember you're saying that one of your favorite forms, your favorite genres was historical fiction. And I said, well, you know, I've got one of those. Can I send it to you? And you said, yes, do that. And I never imagined that it would come to this, but I'm thankful that it did.
I'm thankful, too, and it's a wonderful book. We're going to get to it in a minute, but I want to ask you both, again, I'm just so excited to have two authors to talk to, how you both started writing and how you became published, and also what your influences have been. I know it's kind of a complex question, but Renee, I know you've been a teacher, and Penny, you've been a journalist. So how did you start writing? How did your occupations influence you? And what cities have you lived in? Renee?
I've lived in Philadelphia. I was born in Philly. I've lived outside of Philly now for about 35, 36 years, but I consider myself a Philadelphian, especially during this past week since the Eagles won the Super Bowl. I'm trying to trace back your questions and answer in sort of a logical way. I think that I've been a reader all my life. I have a photo of myself when I was 4 years old, sitting on a little stool with a book in my hands. I think, no doubt, my parents influenced my love of reading. I've never had a problem writing and expressing myself that way, and wrote the typical teenage angst-filled poetry when I was an adolescent. Started writing short fiction, I suppose when I was in college, but I didn't have an outlet for it. Put that away for the next 33 years while I was teaching, and I began writing short fiction again during my summer vacations, especially the last 10 years of my career. I realized at one point that the short fiction I kept coming back to and adding chapters to it. And the first year I was retired, I went Christmas shopping in a bookstore, a Borders bookstore, and I saw a kiosk advertising Borders Personal Publishing. So long story short, I went to a seminar to get information about that, and that's how my first book, Leave of Absence, was published. Then online business started, and I saw an advert for Golden Crown Literary Society. They were having their second or third conference in Atlanta, Georgia. So with my virtually self-published book under my arm, I went to the conference, met some wonderful writers, some wonderful publishers and editors, and by that time I had written the first or second draft of Breaking Jay, and I was discouraged, I should say, by the lead editor of one of the major publishing houses, and at the same time I was encouraged by someone who was working at the time for Regal Crest. So I went home from the conference, did some revision, and then submitted that manuscript to Regal Crest, and it's been happily ever after since then. Regal Crest has published four of my novels and then did a reprint of Leave of Absence after I revised that. The latest book that I'm involved in is called Our Happy Hours, LGBT Voices from the Gay Bars. That idea was born one morning as I was in the shower reflecting about the horrible tragedy at the Pulse nightclub and just thinking how many gay people have been affected emotionally one way or the other by being supported in gay bars, and how were we all assimilating what had happened. About the same time, I read a blog written by Lee Lynch, and she sort of summed up the conclusions I had come to. So that led me to explore mentally the possibility of an anthology, and I contacted Lee and I asked if she would be willing to be my co-story editor, or co-story collector, I should say, and she said she didn't know, she'd have to think about it, she was pretty busy, and then within 24 hours she emailed me back and said, sure, count her in. And so my last experience with publishing was not as the author of the entire book. And I learned so many things working with Lee. I learned so many things about the writers who submitted. And I'm so pleased to say that Penny is a writer whose work is represented within the covers of this anthology.
And that's a perfect segue to ask you the same question, Penny.
I never wanted to do anything else, Elizabeth. From the time that I could hold a book and read one, I wanted to do that. And supported and encouraged by parents who both were voracious readers, but my mother was also a librarian. She was a librarian at Spelman College in Atlanta, which is my hometown. And there were always books. There were always books. There were always books. I also was marked, I suppose, by the hometown newspaper, the Atlanta Constitution, and it had an editor and a publisher who, in my growing up, and that was a really long time ago, and I won't have to say how long unless you really press me, but suffice it to say, were preaching against racial segregation and racism at a time when no white men were doing that. And they received death threats, both of them, and I think Gene Patterson's home was bombed, and it was not, for them, a very pleasant situation. But for me, my parents began the day by saying, let's see what Patterson and McGill are talking about this morning. So I thought, gee, I need to be a newspaper reporter because those people clearly have an impact and clearly influence life, not just in the South, but all over the world. And so that's what I pursued. Still wanting to be a writer, still thinking that at some point I would write novels and plays, but the journalism, the being a newspaper reporter was what galvanized me in my youth. And I was the first black reporter at the Athens, Georgia Banner Herald. And I suppose we've been speaking of serendipity and good luck. But by that time, Eugene Patterson had left the Atlanta Constitution and was an editor at the Washington Post, and who had kept up with me over the years, unbeknown to me. And I got an offer of a summer internship at the Washington Post as I was leaving the Athens Banner Herald. And that was an opportunity. People who were interns, if you could cut it, if you could make the grade, you could earn a spot at the real bottom of the ladder. But that's what I was aiming for. And I became a reporter at the Washington Post. And from there, I went to radio and then television. So I've been a newspaper, radio, and television reporter. And then I decided after 20-some years, like, okay, it's time to now go see if I can be a novelist and a playwright. And that's how that career began. And that's what I've been doing ever since, because it is what I always wanted to do. So I've always written, I suppose.
I can definitely tell your journalistic background in your novels because the research is impeccable. And when I read both this book, Bell City, with all of the technological changes and the history and the towns and the media, the education, and also Death's Echoes set in D.C., you really do your research.
You know, I may be one of the few people, and maybe not. Maybe there are more people than I know about, but I love research. I've always loved it. I know many people who find that the least interesting or compelling part of whether it's a news story or a novel or a play, but it's the part that I always love most. I still do to some extent have to govern myself, because if I go to the library, or now you can do most of it online, if I start to look up something, I can spend an hour detoured because I can find something that, oh, that's interesting, or oh, I didn't know that, and off I go.
I go down the rabbit hole all the time.
It's research, and it's also information and knowledge. And I mean, I love that. I'm a sucker for that. So I appreciate your saying that. Certainly, in the days that I was a reporter, stories were fact checked several times, which is not to say that there were not errors in stories. I'm sure there were, but it was a different world then. And editors fact check stories, and we had to account for information. They wanted to know, how do you know this? Who told you that? And where did you find this out? So I just sort of got used to that. And fortunately, I always had answers because I liked doing the research.
And Renee, you were a teacher for many years, so I'm guessing that's true for you too. I'm guessing you enjoy research.
Well, I enjoy learning, period. And sometimes you can forget that when you're caught in the moment or the months and years of teaching, that there's a kind of beauty to learning something new. There's a kind of beauty to being able to teach something and make it learnable. I have not historically been great at research. However, I think because of my advanced age, I seem more interested now in history, my own history, as well as national history. Certainly, I'm very interested in how democracy works right now. If I'd paid as much attention when I was studying democracy as I do now, I wouldn't have to research it. But I have a character who's begun talking to me, and she is forcing me into some research that I'm actually enjoying. And I can appreciate the payoff when you do a good, thorough job of researching something.
Definitely. I want to turn to the book now, because obviously that's the point of the show. It's mm-hmm. a book club. I was amazed by the scope of this novel, all the way from 1917 up until present time. Can you give us your reaction to the book, Renee?
I enjoyed it thoroughly. I enjoyed the writing. I pay a lot of attention to the craft of writing, I think, when I'm reading something. I enjoyed the names of some of the characters, like First Freedom, for example. It was a good time for me to read this book because in doing some of my ancestry research, I've discovered that both my grandparents were in the Army during World War I. So I found parts of the book that dealt with that to be very interesting. I also found the character Ruthie and where she started and then where she ended to be intriguing. The fact that she loved French and mastered it so well. French is one of the subjects that I used to teach. So I had a big piece of my heart in that character. Some of the lines of dialogue, and I guess, Penny, this is where your playwriting skill comes in, but I guess it was within the first 20, 25 pages, I remember the character Nellie telling Ruthie, "You don't need nobody to tell you who you are or what you can be." And that seems like a simple sentence, but it says so much, and it says so much for the lifetime of Ruthie. I appreciated the way that Penny was able to go from the past to the present in the novel, from one character's viewpoint, one family's viewpoint, to the other character's viewpoint. And I would read those sections, and I'd wonder if it was difficult for you, Penny, to make those transitions. If I could...
Absolutely.
And use a question as part of my answer.
Oh, no, you're welcome to. Please.
Not really, Renee. One of the many reasons that I undertook that novel, and it was truly a labor of love, mm-hmm. and I knew that it would be difficult and time-consuming. That's what I thought I knew. I had no idea how difficult or how time-consuming. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that was not difficult was to move between characters. And mm-hmm. I don't think it's been said in this discussion yet, but let me say that the story is two families, a black family and a white family, but they're the same family. Mm-hmm. And as a Southerner of a certain age, we grew up with that knowledge. We all knew that there was a white side of the family. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that white people wanted to talk about, mm-hmm. and it's not something that a lot of young people know now. Mm-hmm. But I just posed the question. My last name is Mickleberry. No black folk got off a boat from Africa named Mickleberry. Mm-hmm. I had to get that name from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's logical. I mean, it doesn't make sense for people to imagine that my great-great-great-grandparents said, oh, I'm going to name myself Mickleberry.
Mm-hmm.
We got the name from people, either slave owners or the people who owned the land mm-hmm. that we lived on and worked. And so knowing white culture, Southern white culture, mm-hmm. and knowing the voice was something we had to know if we were to survive. Mm-hmm. And that was a great part of the survival instinct and the survival mechanism. Conversely, white people did not have to know us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is evident and manifested in many, many ways. That voice, Renee, is something that just wasn't difficult to understand and to move back and forth
mm-hmm.
between those families and those voices.
Mm-hmm.
I am a fifth generation Georgian. I am a product of that land and of those people, the black ones and the white ones. I know them. I understand them. And I wanted to write that story. I wanted to tell that story mm-hmm. because the other part of this is we too often have not had an opportunity to tell our own stories. Our stories have been viewed through the prism of other people's telling. And mm-hmm. I wanted for myself
yes.
to be able to tell one story of our own and to have it not filtered through somebody else's prism.
Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that although there are many commonalities, there are differences between black folks who are from and have been raised in the South and those who are from or have been raised in the North, specifically the Northeast, that there are subtleties here that might not exist in the South. Things seem to be more blatant in the South, so you know how to react right away. Sometimes up here, because slights are so subtle, certainly you're trained after a while to recognize them. But there's sort of a thread of or a veneer of dishonesty that sometimes runs through or covers the way black and white people in the North interact with each other.
I wish Rahsaan were here because this is one of his issues that he loves to talk about. He talks about microaggressions
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, slights are subtle. But mm-hmm. as you said, they're evident to the person who's receiving them.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have many during the day, it's like a lot of little knife cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the sections of your book or parts of your book that I thought brought this up so well was the brother who never came back from France because mm-hmm. in France he was treated like a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And he married a wife and he had children and he enjoyed so much being fully who he was that he never returned. And it reminded me of the aviator Bessie Coleman. I had seen a one-woman show on her about 20 years ago. And I was just fascinated by the fact that she was the first African-American woman to get a pilot's license, but she had to go to France to do it.
That's right.
Yeah. And let me just to respond very briefly to Renee's earlier comment. I agree partially, Renee, with your take on that, but
mm-hmm.
not totally.
Okay.
I can recall one of the most vivid incidences, well, two, of racial hatred mm-hmm. in this country. One was a school desegregation issue in Boston.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Roxbury, I'm thinking, or
yes.
I don't remember what, but the students were bused from maybe Roxbury into a white neighborhood. And it was one of the most violent, vitriolic racial confrontations. It it rivaled anything I had ever seen out of Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia. And another was, oh, shucks, it was some kind of beach in New York. Some couple of black kids were going to the beach. And some white guys decided that, no, you can't be on this beach. And this is New York City.
Yeah.
And, again, a violent racial confrontation. So certainly the South gets no pass, but neither does the North get a pass from me, because the racism is, and California, which is where I happen to live now, has had many incidences of just really virulent. You would think you were looking at something out of Mississippi or Alabama, as I said, and those in the South was not the only place where we had to endure that kind of thing. Chicago, those places had, and some to some extent still do, histories of such violent and hate-filled treatment of black Americans.
I think the amount of violence and hateful activity is equally distributed in all regions of our country. The difference is that had you gone to a beach in Alabama, there might have been signs that said white beach and then an arrow colored beach over there. When kids went to that beach in New York, or right outside New York City, there weren't signs posted. It was not as in your face, but certainly the violence rained down on them as harshly as it would have in Alabama.
Yeah, but that also wasn't 1940 or 50-something in New York either. That was the 70s, I think. I'm thinking, I can't think of the name. I can't think of the name of the beach where that was. But that was the 1970s. That wasn't, it was, I suppose, what we call modern day.
And the
school right in Alabama.
Business in
Or Georgia or Florida.
Yeah.
And probably in New York. In the 1940s and 50s, there would have been the sign.
Yeah.
And people would have known, like, this is their beach and here's our beach over here. And maybe by the 1970s, we didn't think that was necessary. Like,
no.
It's a beach. It's water.
But it's
water.
And
we can all get in it, and it doesn't do anything. The water doesn't change colors when we get into it.
I hate to break in, but we need to make a station announcement, and
okay.
We're going to come back. So please, both of you, stay on the line. I want to talk more about the book. And we are going to listen to Sweet Honey and the Rock. They are coming to Kansas City February 23rd, and Penny, they're going to be in Georgia, I believe, on the 18th. Their 44 years of a cappella music is just gorgeous. And
They're fabulous. They're fabulous.
They are, and Linda's queued up a song for us.
Bound to exploitation.
What you gonna do?
I'm gonna stand. I just can't tolerate racism.
And we're back with the Santa Moran Radio Book Club talking about Bell City by Penny Mickleberry with Penny and Renee Bess. And I'd like to talk a little, Renee had mentioned the writing techniques and your point of view, the way that you worked in Jonas's diary and Ruthie's memories on her 100th birthday as recorded by Sissy. I thought that was really clever to supplement the omniscient point of view. Penny, did you plan that from the beginning?
Almost from the beginning, Elizabeth. I knew when I was plotting this story out that there was just no way that I could write a linear narrative. I suppose, and I actually was thinking of the Harry Potter books. I'm thinking, my goodness, you know, those are 600- and 700-page books. But it's also about a wizard. And since there were no wizards in my stories, I had to figure out a way to move the story forward, to get a lot of the, not only the details, but a lot of the internal machinations about these two principal characters, Jonas and Ruthie, so that we knew what was going on inside them and how they were feeling about what was going on outside of them in their own families. So, yeah, it was a tool. It was not quite a deus ex machina because there was no, I don't think anything unusual or untoward or unbelievable happened. But, yeah, it was a technique used. And I think from this perspective, and Renee mentioned earlier, I think, both past and present, Jonas's recollections were in diary form, which is what people have been doing for years and years. And he set out to do it, I think, because he wanted to be a writer like Mark Twain. Ruthie's granddaughter got her to talk to the youth into a camcorder, which is very contemporary, very modern day, because, you know, she said, nobody is going to remember this stuff, and you're the only person who knows these stories. And you have to tell it. You have to use this tool to remind all of us what happened and how it happened and what you remember about what happened. So that was a part of it, too, doing as the story moved from the past to the present and as these characters moved from the past to the present, their mode of recollection sort of did the same thing, moved from past to present.
This is an LGBT show, and I was fascinated by the fact that amongst all the characters, you brought in a gay couple, two black men, toward the end of the book. They did not have the experience they would have had in the early 20th century. So I thought that was good, too.
Well, you know, one of the things, again, I wanted to tell a story from my knowledge. This is a Southern story, and it's a Georgia story. And in black families, I mean, there was not, I'm not going to say that, oh, yes, you know, black people were always welcoming, but there was this sense of kind of live and let live, and people knew. I mean, people, you know, there have always been gay people. That's not a modern-day, a contemporary phenomenon. And people, in large part, knew who they were. Now, Bell City, and I have not said this, I don't think we've talked about that, but it is Atlanta. It's a big city. It's Atlanta. And in large cities, we tended to have, as I suppose we do now, a sort of a cosmopolitan population, even though cosmopolitan is not a word I would normally use to describe the South. But there were gay people. People knew who they were. But it wasn't the kind of thing where people could be open as we are now. So, you know, these were men. People knew who they were, and people liked them. But they kind of minded their own business, and they were treated as good and decent human beings, which is what they were. And they found a family within the Thatcher family because their own families had discarded them because of who they were. And I just thought that was an important part of the story.
I think it is.
Because it's a part that I knew from my own experience with my parents and how they treated gay people whom they knew. It wasn't discussed, you know, it wasn't open, but they knew who these people were. And they never disrespected them, just like they never disrespected me and my baby brother, who was also gay. We were never disrespected or mistreated. It was not something that was welcomed. Our parents would have been probably much happier had we not been gay, but they were not unhappy with who we are as people. And as human beings.
One of the, and I won't go into too much detail because I don't want to spoil the book for anyone that hasn't read it, but the idea of slavery being in the past, you make it clear in this book, Penny, that that's not true. Some forms of slavery persist. And I thought that was, it was a real wake-up call for me as a reader, and I think it's an important point to have made.
And until we deal with slavery and what it was and what it did, it will never be in the past. We still reap the vestiges of what slavery did, not just to black people, but to the country. And it still is an issue that a lot of people don't want to talk about because people want to hide behind the, well, I didn't do it, therefore it doesn't have anything to do with me. And that's just such a ridiculous cop-out, I think. And so, yeah, it belongs in our consciousness and in our discussion.
I think one of the things that can counteract it is people being aware and becoming educated. And that leads me to the question that I had asked you, Renee, the importance of education in this book.
Well, I think that Ruthie's character is the embodiment of the importance of education. The fact that she so desperately wanted to go to elementary school, the fact that she became a teacher and then a principal and administrator as an adult, it is one of the best things for any parent, but certainly for an African-American parent, to want for her children or his children to be educated. Without it, it's so hard to move ahead. Even with it, it's extremely hard to move ahead. For the reason I missed a lot of Penny's previous answer because I had to be tapped back in, but I believe she was talking about how, as Americans, we're not willing to sit down and talk about the effects of slavery, that there are too many people who say, I didn't own slaves, and so it's not my problem. I think that very few people have stopped to really think about and understand to the bone what the effects of slavery are. You know, the fact that I will go into a restaurant with my spouse, and a waiter or the waitress will look at her and say what the specials are or what would you like. And, of course, my spouse is on automatic pilot to look at me and say, Renee, what would you like? It's so invasive. I don't mind telling you that I'm 68 years old and I feel disappointed that after all these years we don't seem to have made that many strides.
We had an editorial board member of the Kansas City Star who once a year would put on an old cap and a trench coat. His name was Louis Dugood. He would ride buses. He'd try to catch a taxi, and he was African-American. You can guess that the columns that he wrote from that were not that optimistic because it's not just class. It's also racism. I mean, I think we've seen the responses, really horrifying responses to President Obama and Michelle Obama. Let's talk a little about, in this book, what still persists. For instance, the idea that there were really two separate communities. There was Carey's Crossing, which then became gentrified, and there was Bell City, which, Penny, you indicated that's Atlanta. And so there was the neighborhoods for, you know, black folks and the neighborhoods for white folks. The redlining still exists today, doesn't it? It certainly does here in Kansas City.
Although there are parts of Atlanta, certainly, where if you've got the money, you can go anywhere you want. But it's about a lot of money. But just normally, redlining exists. If you look at the schools and where the so-called good schools are and where the money is spent, and which is why education is still so very important. Because not just in Atlanta, but in cities all over this country, black children are still relegated to poor schools. They just are. And even though some municipalities have made an effort to put the best teachers into those schools, most places don't. So it's the cycle that just continues to go, and it just goes round and round. And so those poorly educated children, and these days a good number of them are also Spanish-speaking children, will not get into college, will not get out of college, will not get the jobs that will allow them to buy their way out of marginal neighborhoods. And that is a holdover from slavery.
And we have a Secretary of Education who is pushing charter schools over trying to improve public schools. It's getting more difficult.
And we have
difficult.
A Secretary of Housing and Urban Development who isn't pushing anything.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
In the book, Jonas works with Ruthie's brother, Beau, and he also has a sister who is not as racist as the rest of his family. So she and her husband work in the store there in Carey's Crossing. And so it's through a network of friendships that a little bit changes in the book. And I thought that that idea of networking and bringing people in is certainly true to change, a way to change minds, a few.
Sometimes I think
people who have, you know, if you have access to something that is different from you, if you're open, you learn from it. And whether it's in the South or in the North, you see, and it was something that happened for Jonas, because even as a child, when he was writing in his diary, his father was a virulent racist, and his description of the black people that they knew is, you know, he would say, oh, they're all, you know, lazy and no count. And Jonas is writing his diary. He said, that can't be true because they work all the time. They're always working. You know, he said that whole family, they're always working, because he climbs a tree to watch the black thatchers on the land. He said all of them are working, the women too. So he doesn't understand what his father is talking about at that point. And it's only as he grows older and has more experience and more connection to black people that he understands that his father's just a racist fool, because what he's saying, his words are lies. They're just not the truth. And that's a tough thing for him to have to accept and to deal with, that your father is a liar.
Oh, he is a virulent hater.
Yeah, and he's a liar out of hatred. And that's what hatred breeds. And that's which is why it's so difficult. I mean, all we have to do is look at what we're confronting in the country now, is the hatred and the lies. Well, and people who would rather believe lies fed by their hatred.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why in the book I was so glad every time we were reading about Big Cy, Will, Bo, Tobias, First Freeman, Little Cy, because that felt more like a family. And Jonas was out there on his own, really.
Yeah, he was.
Mm-hmm. And I just felt sad for him. And again, I'm not going to spoil anything, but the other family was healthy. And even when they were fighting, it was in a healthier way. They weren't screaming imprecations at each other.
And again, you see, that's what hatred does. I mean, Jonas was afraid. He was so afraid of his violent father that he was afraid to show love to his mother. Because he was afraid of what his father would do.
I had forgotten that. Yes, she was Scottish,
yeah.
Wasn't she?
Yeah. And why she didn't, and I guess, again, giving away too much of the book, but why she didn't harbor the hatred of black people that her husband did, is that she came to this country as an indentured servant. She was sold. But the difference between black slaves and white ones is that white could earn out their servitude. But she told Jonas, you know, that she has no hatred for those people, because they were treated just like she was. She was a servant. She was an indentured servant, which meant that she was, to some extent, a slave. So she didn't hate the slaves, because she, you know, that old saying, there but for the grace of God, she was just fortunate that she was able, in fact, it was Jonas's father who bought her servitude.
This whole story was so complex and so sweeping, we can't possibly deal with it in an hour. But I would like to kind of sum up by quoting one Renee Bess, if that's okay.
Sure.
It's important for us to tell our own stories because we need to affirm our right to exist in the world and in the body of lesbian and gay literature. Many times we are not only invisible to the non-black gay and lesbian community, we are invisible to each other. I have found from being in online groups and talking to people and going to conventions, that's absolutely true. Renee, would you respond to your own words?
Well, they were my words. Within the company of lesbian writers, I have from time to time found myself feeling invisible. more so, of course, than in the company of African-American lesbian writers. But there, it's just a microcosm of the macrocosm where, you know, we might feel ignored in the world as in general or in the United States in general. That's a pattern that repeats and repeats and repeats itself. And when you are recognized, it's another one of those microaggression type recognitions.
As an example, but someone asked for writers of color, and people started mentioning white writers who had characters of color. And then there were a number of mentions of Alice Walker, and she's a great writer. But it was like, and then people were mentioning Penny Mickleberry, Cheryl Head, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it took a while. I'm obviously white, but I find it frustrating because I will throw out a name and people go, is it romance? Does it have a happy ending?
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's a mystery.
It's sort of like, I call it the Jeopardy effect. When on Jeopardy, if a question comes up that has to do with African-American culture, the white contestants can't hit that button. They don't know the answer. An African-American person, of course, would know the answer. But the African-American contestant can also answer questions about Johann Sebastian Bach or something in white or Euro-white culture. So it's that double consciousness that black folks have to have.